Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Man City take the Championship takes Fulham, and Arsenal's first win at the Bridge in a decade keeps the top four race alive, as long as you're listening to this before Liverpool strip to Old Trafford on Thursday. We look ahead to a big weekend for Chelsea, the FA Cup final with Leicester, and the Champions League final with Barcelona, with the women's team in one and Werner in the other, which will feature more misses. We'll also hear from Leicester as they enjoy a fine late-season crumble, and we'll discover the identity of our second finalist in the Inter Totally Cup. It's all on the way in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And hello, listener. It's May the 13th for us, Thursday morning, and on board today's Totally... It's an exciting lineup with Michael Cox. Hello, Michael.
Hi, James.
Lovely to see Dom Fifield with us as well.
Hello, James.
And Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Hello, Duncan. Early question for you. Q at Kaz B says, any substance to the rumours Derby getting a points deduction and Wickham staying up instead? What is this, Duncan?
Well, I'm not sure they're rumours. It's more conjecture. So Derby have lost their appeal, or the Football League rather have won their appeal against Derby protesting the original crime. And it's all now about when they apply the sanction. So the difficulty is that the Sheffield Wednesday obviously were deducted 12 points this season and then reduced to 6. Now Derby's offence took place at the same time. So theoretically it should be applied to this season. But
the offence was an accountancy thing, yes?
Yeah. Yeah, sort of, you know, creative accountancy. This goal frame is worth 40 right. million. So, yeah, you know, that sort of thing. So, but obviously Wickham, having spent nearly the whole season in 24th, jumped up to 22nd with a few minutes to go on the final day.
Your own Aguero moment could be in store.
Well, as someone pointed out, we went up last season thanks to PPG. We could be staying up thanks to FFP. I'm not sure what other acronyms we can use next season to get promoted to the Premier League, but we should look into it. So, I mean, my feeling at the moment is that the sanction will probably come next season, so Wickham won't survive. But there's still a chance. And I mean, if you think about it, Wickham's budget for the entire season is probably less than a couple of one Derby player. So, you know, in kind of financial moral terms, then I think Wickham probably should get another crack.
Your entire budget is less than the value of the sofa in Derby's new owner's living room, from what I can see on his TikTok account.
Yes. Well, it's not his TikTok, is it?
So no. What are you going to tell me now?
Well, the new owner put up... There's been rumours about whether he has the financial backing and strength that he purports to, and he put up a picture of a flash house... and then immediately people spotted that it was also on a kind of, here's a flash house TikTok account. So, yeah, a bit strange.
It is a bit unusual. Eric Alonso, Derby's prospective new owner. Well, more no doubt to come from that story. And, of course, this extraordinary waiting that Wickham now have to do to know about their future must be so difficult for you. At least there have been some exciting midweek games to take your mind off it in the meantime. Significant ones as well. Monday... saw Fulham lose 2-0 at home to Burnley, which confirmed the Cottagers in the final relegation spot, followed by a raw, open post-game Scott Parker interview, of course. Tuesday saw Saints beating Palace 3-1. The return of Danny Ings there. And also that day, a 2-1 victory for Leicester at Man United, which saw Leicester all but wrap up their top four spot and confirm Man City as champions. Wednesday, meanwhile... the other top four spot opened up a little bit again thanks to Jorginho's no-look pass and Arsenal's surprise win at Chelsea. which leaves Chelsea now 6 points clear of West Ham, who have one game in hand, and 7 points clear of Liverpool, who have two games in hand. Liverpool, of course, will be playing one of those Thursday night at Old Trafford. If they win that, it does get very interesting. We'll discuss the top four race and all that later on. Aston Villa also in action against Everton on Thursday night. Let's kind of begin, though, with a bit of a verbal guard of honour for a team that wasn't playing. Manchester City, confirmed as champions for the third time in four seasons, in honour of this incredible comeback title victory. It's not been mentioned much, but they're all the way down in 13th, etc. What's been your favourite, your most treasured thing about this campaign from Man City, Dom?
Treasured. the thing, I mean, I was thinking about this last night, the afternoon where I sort of thought, wow, they are just going to win this now, they're going to steamroll all the rest, was when they came to Stamford Bridge in the first week of January. In one of Frank Lampard's last games, probably the nail in Frank Lampard's coffin at Chelsea as well. They scored twice in 2 minutes, but it was the third goal, really. It was the way Kevin De Bruyne effectively assisted Raheem Sterling. I mean, he should have done it. Should have been an assist with a header from the edge of his own penalty area that put Sterling completely free and alone beyond N'Golo Kanté into the Chelsea half. And okay, Sterling then gets forced wide and he doesn't pick a pass. He has a shot and he hits the post. But it's De Bruyne who's made the run from deep to pick up the loose ball and put it in. And it was just the manner in which they completely wiped the floor with Chelsea that day. And you know, a team that had just gone on a 14-match unbeaten run or whatever it was in the middle of the season and who had done so well in the Champions League group stage were just made to look like idiots that day. I mean, City were just a class apart. And that was one of the early games in what proved to be, God, was it 21 in a row or something daft? They just won every week. And it just sort of showed the gulf of class. Amazing team. Thoroughly deserved title.
All right. And amazing kind of bipolar season that they've been having. Duncan, what's your standout thought about City?
Yeah, I mean, to sort of echo Dom a bit, I mean, I think this season has been very much around performing away from home. And I think City, you know, if they win their next away game, they've set a new all-time top flight record for consecutive away wins. And, you know, United are about to set an unbeaten Premier League away season. And I think we kind of expected this would happen, but it was the way that they didn't panic in the autumn. I mean, you know, everyone does this, but everyone... It is hard to remember, but Liverpool won 7-0 at Palace and they were top. Sorry, Dom. And they were top. Ooh, and everyone was...
Why does that...
It's weird, isn't it? and everyone pretty much said, well, that's, you know, Liverpool, it's not a classic season and Liverpool don't look as strong as last season, but they should wrap it up. Mm. And then that run of consecutive wins that City put together, which, you know, obviously surpassed the fake one that they had where they included a draw against Wolves in the League Cup from a few years back. And you know, that it was that consistency, and I don't think we expected that from them this season. And I think, you know, the way they set up with kind of playing a little bit deeper and sort of relying a bit more on, you know, Ruben Dias and John Stones to kind of form a sort of old school centre half partnership, which again wasn't something we really saw before. And, you know, the fact that Guardiola has finally built a new team at a club, which he'd never done before. And I think that's pretty ominous for the rest of the league because, you know, he's kind of built this new side that looks like it could dominate for the next few years. So it's been a real kind of triumph from adversity for City, I think.
They do look ominously good. The one thing that I think this season has been another illustration of is that things that seem permanent can often prove far from it. Michael, what's been your takeaway from it all? What would you like to salute?
My most memorable game is probably the 4-1 win at Anfield. I know Liverpool aren't the force of last year, but I think winning convincingly away at the reigning champions is always quite a symbolic win. But I think realistically, I mean, the defining moment of the campaign hasn't come yet. It will come down to the Champions League final. If they win the European Cup, that's what we'll remember it for. And if they don't win the European Cup, they'll be in this, maybe embarrassing is the wrong word, but this slightly awkward situation of being league champions by miles and yet not fulfilling their major objective for the season and losing to a side who finished a few places below them in the league. So, Yeah, I'll wait till the end of the month before I completely have a defining moment for their campaign.
All right, we'll get back to you on that. In the meantime, they are the first team in Premier League history to win the title after being as low as eighth in the table on Christmas Day. This season, of course, got underway a little bit later, so that skewed things a little bit. Pep Guardiola, meantime, has won the league title in 9 of his 12 seasons as a manager. 3 at Barca, 3 at Bayern, and this is now his 3rd at City. Remarkable. Well, Man City aren't involved in the FA Cup final, but Chelsea and Leicester are. We'll be counting down to that. Looking back at some of the midweek action next.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Chelsea against Leicester in the 140th FA Cup final this Saturday at 5:15. For Leicester, it'll be their 5th appearance in the big game. Their first, though, since the summer of 69. No team has reached the final so often without actually winning this trophy. Chelsea have won it. This is their 4th final appearance in 5 years. Of course, they got beaten in their last one last summer by Arsenal, which, curiously enough, what happened to them midweek as well. Are you looking forward to the game, Michael?
Yeah, I am, actually. I really like the FA Cup. I think there's been a few good finals in recent years, and I think this is the kind of final you want, where there's two good teams, there's a favourite, there's a bit of an underdog, who I think if they won it, obviously it would mean so much to them because they've never won it before. It's not like a Chelsea-Arsenal situation where it becomes one of many. And they're both good teams to watch. I usually go into FA Cup finals thinking, this could be a bit cagey, but I just think this will be a really interesting game. And also, as I think I've said before on this podcast, but we shouldn't take it for granted that we've got the FA Cup done this year. I mean, the period where the proper non-league sides were required for the FA Cup was coincidentally the only time in the last 14 months where they'd been playing. So I had my doubts that we would get an FA Cup final in May this year. I thought it might have to be delayed, as, for example, the women's one has. But we've got through it, and that's a great thing.
Brilliant. Yeah, one game to go. The underdogs you mentioned there, presumably that's Chelsea, is it, who are below Leicester in the table after Chelsea's midweek defeat to Arsenal. Dom, what happened there?
Well, they weren't very good in either box, so they didn't really deserve anything other than the 1-0 home defeat. I mean, that they were gifted the goal, Arsenal, but Chelsea created enough chances and to have won it. They hit the crossbar twice and then the second half. I thought Tuchel's post-match was really honest and refreshing, accepting blame, 7 changes, a lot of disruption in terms of rhythm. A lot of players that he picked were probably rusty when they came in, but they also didn't seize the opportunity that they'd been given to warrant mention in terms of inclusion for the 2 cup finals they have to come. And it just looked like one game too far, really. Maybe they were a bit distracted. But look, it's a great win for Arsenal. I love the fact that it's the first time Arsenal have beaten Chelsea home and away in a season since they're invincible, because the contrast between these two Arsenal teams could not be starker.
Nature is healing.
Indeed. But it's, yeah, fair play. It was a great win for Arsenal. And it's maybe just a little nudge to Chelsea that although things have been going very, very well, that they're not in a position yet where they can rest on their laurels. They don't have a natural goal scorer. They don't have a number 9 who's going to get them 20 goals a season. They haven't even got a player that's got double figures, I don't think, in this season. So if they don't take the chances that come their way, they won't win matches. They won't win their games. And those are big 2 cup finals coming up. They've got to be more ruthless than they were last night.
Was Sammy tweeting in with this question? Do you think Chelsea's result last night highlights their need for a better quality focal point? There have been those saying that bringing in a classic centre-forward would disrupt the delicate mechanisms that Tuchel's been perfecting. What's your take on this?
I think it's quite good timing for Chelsea to lose that game. Obviously, if it turns out they then miss out on the top 4 and then lose the Champions League final, then it won't be. But it's quite a good reminder for them ahead of 2 massive cup finals that, you know, that they're not just this defensive super machine. I mean, for me, there's been 999 own goals in Premier League history, and look how close we came to Jorginho scoring possibly one of the best ever to make it 1,000. That's the heritage we almost saw last night. I take slight exception. I mean, it was a big win for Arsenal, but they didn't play that well. I mean, I think you replay that game and Chelsea win it most times. I mean, Arsenal only had 9 touches inside the opposition penalty box, which is their lowest in a win recorded in Premier League history. So it was, and as we discussed, the goal was very much a Chelsea mistake. But I think it's good for the league as a whole because it really does set up the top four race. I mean, we're recording this ahead of the United-Liverpool game, obviously, which could change things. But it is now back in Liverpool's hands. You know, they win their last four games and they are in the top four.
But hang on, Liverpool are 7 points back with two games in hand. So if they win those two, they'll still be a point behind Chelsea.
But Chelsea and Leicester play each other. So unless there's an extraordinary point-sharing scenario, that one of them will drop points there. So it's a tough ask for Liverpool. But, you know, I think if it's all they can hope for, really, you know, back in their hands. So
absolutely.
I think it's worth pointing out, I mean, it was a crazy error from Jorginho, but Arsenal were trying to press high and they were getting four men around the ball. I mean, I think it was Elneny was pressuring Jorginho. Jorginho looked over his shoulder and the passing option wasn't there for because Aubameyang was in the way. And Arsenal have got a few goals since Arteta took over from that kind of pressing and forcing mistakes high up the pitch. And obviously you don't expect someone to nearly hoof it in their own goal from 30 yards, but you wouldn't get Tottenham under Mourinho getting that kind of lucky break because they were sitting back in their own third. So the entire idea of pressing is to force errors from the opposition inside their own third. And this was just an extreme example of that.
Mm. And their lack of touches in the Chelsea box was down to the fact that post that goal, they were hanging on to what they had.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Dunga that they barely created anything aside from a decent move for a Bellerin chance, but it's dependent on the situation in the game, isn't it? I thought they actually defended quite well deep. I mean, that's not something we associate with Arsenal doing very well, but don't think Chelsea had that many clear goal-scoring opportunities.
Yeah, it felt like, I remember last season when Arsenal, towards the end, and they won the FA Cup, they had a few sort of performances like this, and it felt quite similar to that. And I actually thought watching the game, if someone had woken up having been asleep for 20 years and you showed them that game, the number of times both teams just passed it around in their own penalty box under pressure, that's so different to 20 years ago. And if you hadn't seen that develop, people would be astounded at how football changed. It really was.
That's certainly what would strike somebody about who'd just woken up from 20 years ago about the world.
To yeah.
But they're passing more.
Well, no fans at Stamford Bridge. Yeah, that makes a change.
Daniel's story pointing out, and this I think gobsmacks anybody whether you've been asleep or not, over the last 25 league games, Arsenal and Chelsea have taken exactly the same number of points. My brain, says Daniel, cannot compute how this can be the case. It is a troubling one, that.
It's astonishing.
I mean, I haven't checked his numbers, but he's Daniel's story. So, anyway.
Is this not just a case of Arsenal? Every time Arsenal lose, it's a huge event. And when they, you know, get a perfunctory win against Burnley or someone, it just sort of no one really notices. So, I mean, yeah, I know what he means, but
possibly,
you can't outrun maths.
Well, one big difference between those two clubs is the fact that Chelsea do have those two massive finals, the Champions League at the end of this month and the FA Cup final with Leicester this weekend. And of course, another final coming up this week as well, this weekend, the Women's Champions League. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But Leicester, in contrast to Chelsea, arrive at Saturday evening's game, buoyed by their midweek result, a 2-1 victory at Man United, their first win at Old Trafford since January 1998. Which is before four of the United starting 11 had been born. Crikey. It is a result that does a lot to confirm their Champions League place, although Duncan's throwing fresh doubt on that. But it's still not a bad position for a team that we had been discussing crumbling once again. Seasoned Fox watcher Joe Bruin from 442 joins us now. Joe, thanks for joining us. Quite an end of season crumble that Leicester are having then. First win at Old Trafford for 23 years, top four place looking good, and an FA Cup final. Crikey.
Yeah, it kind of sums up what it's like supporting Leicester City. I mean, it kind of hit home the other week when we saw poor Southend getting relegated to the National League, when it was sort of only 2009 when we were winning the League One title at Roots Hall. And playing the likes of Hereford and Stockport, who are obviously now in non-league with them. Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I wasn't actually expecting to be in this position. As you can imagine, it's been 52 years since we last got to an FA Cup final. So I've obviously never seen it in my lifetime. But yeah, you learn to expect kind of anything with Leicester.
Mm. Well, even after that Southend game 6 years ago, you're battling to stay up in the Premier League and looking pretty much in danger of dropping out of the division. Since then, you've won the title. You're set for a second season in the Champions League. And this weekend, you could win your first ever FA Cup. How big would that be?
It would be huge, no doubt about that. There's the constant debate about what the FA Cup means to fans. But, you know, for a club like Leicester, it means the world. I mean, I think if you offered fans now the chance, you know, if it's FA Cup or Champions League, if you had to make that hypothetical decision, most of them would definitely pick the FA Cup. Having never got close to this point before, knocked out once by Duncan's fair team in the early noughties.
Apologies.
As I'm sure he would like to remind us all. Yeah, we just haven't got to this position before. Actually, as a Leicester fan, I've actually never been to Wembley for a final. The new Wembley, anyway. We went to the 2000 League Cup final. But since then, we've only played there for the Community Shield final and for against Tottenham in a league game, which doesn't really count. So it does mean a lot, despite the fact that we're obviously only going to have about 6,000 of our fans there.
Mm. Still, I mean, that's great to finally get some supporters in there for the big game. The midweek win came after a pretty worrying set of results. The defeat to Newcastle, the failure to beat 10-man Southampton. What was the difference then away to Man United? Was it Ollie's team selection? And how big a part? What do you want to tell us about the extraordinary young Luke Thomas?
Yes, so there's no doubt that Man United handed us a gift with that team selection. But after Friday night against Newcastle, I think we absolutely needed it because there's definitely some worries creeping in. I mean, I know there's been a lot of talk about Leicester bottling it like they did last season, but this season was not like last year. I mean, that was a proper collapse last year with only one team for competition. We let Man United in and it kind of felt inevitable from about February, March onwards before lockdown. This year's been a little bit different in that there's been far more competition for that. But the way that we went 4-0 down at home to Newcastle did just point to a side that smacked of a lack of confidence at the crucial moment. So going to Old Trafford, getting that win, I'm not going to say it's going to secure top four, but it's definitely a huge step towards doing that. It was great to see Luke Thomas obviously score that worldie, if you could call it worldie, I'll do. Local lad, as we've got a few in the team, with Harvey Barnes as well. He's actually struggled a little bit this season when he's come in at times, but there's definitely something about him, and it's not easy to step into a team when you've had James Justin playing so well for most of the season. He's been a massive, massive loss for us. So for Luke to get that goal was superb for him.
Yeah, he took it so confidently. I mean, even to make the shout, presumably for Jamie Vardy to leave it, and then finish what was by no means an easy shot so confidently, remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, the ironic thing is that Luke Thomas is probably more likely to score than Jamie Vardy at the moment, which is the sad thing. But yeah, it does just point to the confidence that he's got right now. It says a lot for the way he's come back into the team. I mean, we got beat at home by Arsenal a couple of months ago, and he had a really torrid game. Got booked, got dragged off, actually. So the way he's just come and slotted in, replacing Ben Chilwell, you know, pretty seamlessly at sometimes. It's really nice to see that from a Leicester fan's perspective.
Excellent. All right, well, a great preparation for Saturday's game. Nobody, as I mentioned before, has been to more FA Cup finals without winning than the Foxes. What do you reckon on your chances this time against Chelsea? Covidiot writing in saying, in what ways and areas can Leicester hurt Chelsea on Saturday, Joe?
Well, actually, one of our best performances of the season was against Chelsea at home. It was a time when Chelsea's confidence was low, and it might have been the game but just before Frank Lampard got sacked, actually. They're not the Chelsea that they are now. But, you know, with this Leicester team, you know, if they're on it, Johnny Evans looks like he's going to be back as well, which is another big boost. That's the hope, anyway. Still a bit touch and go, I think. You know, Chelsea are the favourites, don't get me wrong, but I think as a Leicester fan, you always know that you're capable of doing something in a game.
All right, me duck. Best of luck on Saturday then, Joe. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Joe Bruin. You often hear the expression, trouble is my middle name. With him, I imagine that's particularly redolent. So, Michael, you've given us your thoughts on Chelsea being the favourites and that for this. Dom, Duncan, what's your take?
I think the way that Tuchel has prepared his teams for game-specific occasions, which with build-up, I think he probably that they would be favourites if they. I don't think they'll be making the same mistakes that Frank Lampard's team made that night, for example, at the King Power when they were outclassed and James Maddison gave the masterclass. So I would fancy Chelsea to recover from their setback in midweek in a game that they know they have to win, really, and to claim that first silverware of Tuchel's tenure. But there will be a threat. I mean, there is a lot of quality in that Leicester team. Iheanacho is a player reborn. Tielemans is excellent on the quiet, almost. Ndidi's ticking again. And if Johnny Evans is back to help stabilise their back line, then they'll be more resilient than they have been of late. So I think it'll be a really, really good occasion.
Yeah, Michael said earlier that it feels like a really well set up cup final. And I think it is. You know, obviously we've only had two non-Big Six teams win the cup since 1995, Portsmouth and Wigan. And then we've had recent cup finals like Watford getting beaten 6-0 by City, which wasn't really much fun for anyone apart from Kevin De Bruyne. So I think hopefully it's a pretty close game. I mean, everyone knows Leicester have got this record of never having won the FA Cup, having been to four finals. They're the only teams who have won the league and not have won the FA Cup before. So it really does feel like it's a good time. And also Jamie Vardy, as Joe mentioned, you know, in the olden days where the build-up to cup final would have started at 10 with the coaches leaving and Saint and Greavesy and all that stuff, the story of Jamie Vardy, a man who I saw knock Wickham out of the FA Cup when he was playing for non-league Fleetwood at the time, you know, playing in a cup final would have been a really romantic, huge thing. I think that would be relatively underplayed this week. But Jamie Vardy scoring a FA Cup final winning goal, I think, would be quite a nice little story covering the sort of last decade of football, really.
I remember the cup final build up for features like cooking with Robbie Savage. Do you remember that one, James?
Go on.
I just have this memory of you about 8 years ago doing some
that happened
thing in the kitchen, which just really
something in the kitchen with Robbie Savage and some whipped cream. Laughs ensued, which may or may not involve my head. Yeah, that was, I mean, when you look back with that kind of nostalgic air to when the build-up began at 10 in the morning, etc., my God, there was some time to fill. And the features you get in there, and the case in point. Anyway, so, yeah, much better now that we jump in 15 minutes before. There's your team, bosh, off you go. especially because, you know, here they are in the FA Cup final, but they're going to meet all over again on Tuesday in what could be an absolutely huge game as well for top four places, especially with that new information, Duncan, about them, you know. That's the game you were talking about earlier.
Is the FA Cup final a dress rehearsal for the league game? Is that how it works?
Possibly, yeah. Possibly, yeah. All right, well, 5:15 anyway, the first of this interesting series between Leicester and Chelsea. We'll look ahead to the weekend's Premier League fixtures in a bit. But next up, let's talk about Sunday's other big cup final, which is Chelsea against Barcelona in the Women's Champions League in Gothenburg.
Harry, is there any truth in the rumours that you're off to Spain in the summer?
Sorry, me no hablo inglés.
What about one of the Manchester clubs?
Well,
Harry, what about my source who says you're keen to stay at Spurs?
Can we keep the question sensible, please?
Kane's future at Spurs remains uncertain, but you're guaranteed to get money back as a free bet if one leg of your fourfold acca lets you down. Paddy Power!
Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive, exclude shop bets and enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Well, it's a big month of May for Chelsea. They've got FA Cup Saturday, the Champions League in Porto at the end of the month, and this Sunday in Gothenburg, the Women's Champions League final. Katie Wyatt joins us now. Hello, Katie.
Hi, are you okay?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you as you build up to a match you've described as the finest women's Super League team ever assembled against all-conquering Barcelona?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I feel like I'm becoming a bit of the Emma Hayes correspondent at the moment because there's obviously such a big focus on everything that she's achieved and she's built at Chelsea, and rightfully so, because they're just a phenomenal team and her management style is really, really unique and she deserves all the plaudits that she's getting. But I think on the game itself, it's just such an exciting time for, you know, I've been covering women's football for a few years in the national media now, and this is the first time that I've seen an English team in the Champions League. But for those who have followed the game for a lot longer than I have, they've been waiting. 2007 was the last time. It wasn't even called the Champions League then, so it's been a very, very long wait, but it will be a very close final, I anticipate, with two, as that you said in that quote there, two really, really fine teams going up against each other.
Chelsea, I think, made everybody around Europe sit up and take notice with their second leg against Bayern, and then just last weekend blew Reading away to wrap up the WSL title. Can we expect more of that kind of free-scoring play in Gothenburg?
I think it depends really on whether Barcelona could find a way to stop Sam Kerr and Fran Kirby. Because they're obviously, as we know and has been very well documented, the two jewels in Chelsea's crown. And what I thought was interesting was I was at the Barcelona press conference yesterday and asked Lika Martins, who is in turn the jewel in their crown and their Euros winner and World Cup finalist, and I said, how are you going to stop Sam Kerr and Frank Kirby? And she was saying that with the style of football that they play, obviously Barcelona teams dominate the ball, and when you do that, it's a very good defensive strategy. And she sort of said, well, let's see how they do if they don't have the ball, which I thought was a very interesting sentiment. And I think it's certainly going to be one of the closest finals. I think in recent years we've seen Lyon just dominate them and win the finals 3 or 4-0, which isn't a great spectacle, but this year I think it will just be so close with the enormously attacking talents that Chelsea have. But then Barcelona have scored almost twice as many league goals as Chelsea have, so both of them are really, really free scoring teams, so it would be interesting to see how they cancel out each other's threats. But they're two very good, stubborn defensive teams that haven't conceded a lot this season. So it's very much the same strengths against the same strengths. But in terms of their playing style, they're executed in a very different way. So it's quite a lot to go at and quite a lot to look at. And I think it will make for a really interesting tactical battle.
Oh, brilliant. Excitingly, Sunday we'll also see a new Women's Champions League anthem unveiled, amongst other things, by UEFA in their big revamp of the competition.
I think that's actually coming on Monday, but it's part of a spate of reforms that UEFA are introducing that I think are just really exciting and probably particularly timely given the avenue that the European Super League wanted to take women's football down, in an idea that, as was a lot of people were saying, didn't seem very well thought out. But the way that the UEFA have kind of restructured the Champions League is at €24 million in prize money, massive increase on prize money on what you can currently get. I think the winning teams, because it's accrued cumulatively based on how many games you win and where you start and everything like that, it's currently €390,000, and that's going to go to over €1 million for next year. So that's a huge development, as well as all of the solidarity payments that teams are going to get to clubs that are not competing in the league, so that they can build a little bit as well. So it's a huge redesign of the competition that really is going to help women's football across Europe step up a level. But obviously that needs to be matched by the investment in clubs. They can't just be reliant on these grants and these handouts to bankroll their women's teams. They very much need to step on board. But that's a really fabulous incentive for them to do that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It is remarkable how every year it seems that there's another kind of massive shift of the paradigm, a massive leap forward in terms of the size and structure of the women's game, even in the middle of a year like this one that's been so difficult.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really key point to make, that I remember last year when the pandemic was kicking off, that there was so much uncertainty in every industry, because ultimately no one's ever had to deal with anything like this in our lifetime, but particularly for women's football, because historically it's always been the first things to be cut when clubs have been relegated or clubs have had financial team, because a lot of clubs don't see it as a key arm of their business. They don't see it as profitable. They don't view it as legitimate. So there are lots of reasons why it's always been very, very vulnerable. I think there are a lot of reasons why it still is vulnerable. I think the story that came out about Birmingham City and their training facilities this week, some of the noises coming out of Manchester United after Casey Stoney's resignation this week, there were reminders that even with the new TV deal and all the new broadcast deal and finances, there are still lots of ways that the women's game needs a lot more help and support and infrastructure building. But there is so much going on that certainly gives you hope that from a commercial perspective, women's football has really, really come along in the last few years.
Brilliant. All right, we're looking forward to Sunday's showpiece final. And do you want to call it for us?
I'm going to have to say Chelsea, aren't I, because I'm an English. I was thinking about this right. The other day because I was talking to someone and I was saying, do you remember when you were a kid and you used to go to Spain and everybody used to be running around in Barcelona shirts and you used to ask your parents for one and they just wouldn't buy you one, even not even like a cheap £10 one off the market. So when it was, I was thinking about it the other day and I was like, who would I be rooting for if I was a neutral? But I think you've got to root for Chelsea. You know, we've been covering them all year and I've seen the project that Emma Hayes has built there. And my heart is very much saying that it will be Chelsea's year.
All right. That sounds like a traumatic trip to Spain back in the day.
Did your parents buy you Barcelona kits off the market or were they too stubborn in Yorkshire like mine were?
I got one.
Did you get one, Duncan?
Yeah, but it fits me now, and I got it when I was like 13. So God knows what my mum was doing in terms of you'll grow into this. It's pushing the boundaries. So, but it's actually quite good now because it's from back in the day. So yeah.
Yeah, nice. Casey, brilliant. Well, listen, have a great time on Sunday and speak to you soon.
Thanks.
Katie Wyatt. Dom, how big would it be for Chelsea to do a men's women's 1-2? I mean, it'd be unprecedented, no?
Absolutely unprecedented. So huge. And also, I think, testament to the amount of resources that the club have poured into the women's game. That complex at Cobham is something else. Mm. On whether it be first team, men's, the academy, and now the women's side as well. It's an incredible facility. And the trophy for Emma Hayes would be like that would be tremendous.
Yeah, I think from a British perspective, everyone's watched a lot of Chelsea this year and knows how good they are. But I mean, Barcelona come into the final as really strong favourites. I mean, they absolutely blew away Manchester City, who were only a couple of points behind Chelsea in the WSL this year. And I must say, I hadn't seen a lot of Barcelona. I don't watch them domestically, but in the Champions League, they've been exceptional. And I think a lot of people who are watching them for the first time will be amazed at how good the quality passing is in midfield. They've got a player, Aitana Bonmatí, who's just a brilliant deep-lying playmaker. Alexia Putellas is broadly an Iniesta-type player who takes the game to the opposition. I think the two ways that Chelsea can probably win the game is, one, Barcelona are not good at defending set pieces, and Chelsea have scored two pretty good goals from set pieces in the game against Bayern and then the opener against Reading. And second, Barcelona, one of their centre-backs, Andrea Pereira, who I think has played pretty much every Champions League game this season, is suspended. I think it's really harsh to be suspended for the Champions League final for two yellows, but she's out. And I'm not sure they have a real obvious centre-back replacement, so they might be moving one of the full-backs inside or dropping a holding midfielder in. Yeah, in separate games, you know, like accumulation. But whereas in the men's Champions League, obviously, you don't have that anymore. I think there's a cut-off after the...
After Nedved.
Yeah, that was the best example, wasn't it? But that's a big issue for Barcelona. So I think Barcelona will dominate the game, but Chelsea on the break and with set pieces, I think have got a chance of an upset. But it would be an upset. I think Chelsea are bigger underdogs for this than they are for the men's Champions League final, personally.
Interesting. All right, the men's Champions League final coming up on the 29th of May, but as we now understand, it is in Portugal. The logic of moving it from Istanbul, because English fans can't travel there, but still not having it in UK anyway, I'm a little bit sketchy on that. There were questions over how much of the quarantine waivers that UEFA were requesting for all the staff coming in to stage the event at, say, Wembley, which apparently won't be such an issue in Portugal. But it does seem weird if you're moving it. Why don't you just move it to the UK still?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I also think if it had been played at an English ground, it would have just, as we said last week, it would have felt a little bit like a League Cup or an FA Cup final. So at least if it's abroad, it's got that bit of Euro glamour to it. So
nice. Okay. Still to come, we've got the second semi-final in our Intertotally. But next up, we'll have a little rummage through the weekend's dregs of the Premier League and see what they have to offer.
Keep listening for Julien Laurent versus Benji Lagnado in the Intertotally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. And we apologise for any bad language you may hear.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
It's the 13th of May, listener, still. And, of course, on this day, 9 years ago, this.
Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero!
Crikey. As you know, it's the only time the Premier League title has ever been decided on goal difference, and it is just about the best finish to a league ever. It never gets old, that, really. Duncan, you did something on this recently where you were breaking it down over at the Premier League.
Yeah, it was more Leon Osman than me, but it's the first time I've seen this goal, because on the day it was just like, wow, this is an incredible thing. I'd never seen it get the proper sort of, you know, analysis treatment, and Leon picked out a few good points. Just before the goal is scored, the move starts from QPR having a throw-in in City's own half. And they could have gone down the line, and that would have probably just eaten up a few more seconds. They throw it inside and immediately lose it, which then launches the attack. And the other thing I hadn't really noticed before is the Balotelli. Obviously, everyone knows that famously that was his only assist in the Premier League. If you actually look at it really closely, I think he's trying to pass to David Silva, and it kind of slightly doesn't go the way he intended and just falls.
He sort of falls over. Yeah,
but he kind of, as he does, he sees Silva and he kind of tries to hook it, but it ends up going to Aguero. And I hadn't really ever thought about how much Aguero is absolutely clattered as he hits the ball. I mean, City would have definitely got a penalty if he hadn't have scored that goal. Mm. I think that's the thing that's, you know, maybe that would have been even more dramatic. Because as he hits it, the defender basically just goes straight through his standing leg. And actually, as he scores, he's grimacing because of the pain. But then, you know, that falls away pretty quickly. But, yeah, I mean, it is the most seminal moment of the Premier League, if not English top-flight history.
Well, you got the Dzeko goal just before this. City, who'd been needing two goals as the 90 minutes finished to wrest the title back from Man United. QPR, meanwhile, battling for their top flight survival. So much to enjoy in this game. Balotelli's only Premier League's assist ever. Joe Hart setting that record for the most throw-ins taken by a Premier League goalkeeper. Roberto Mancini setting a record for the number of times saying "f*** you" to every City player you see. And also
Joey Barton.
Barton, who I felt was unfairly treated there, because the number of swings that Aguero has at him before he gives him the Barton elbow. Anyway, you know, there's good people on both sides. But yes, it never gets old, that game. Unlikely to see anything settled on goal difference this season, perhaps. We've got City confirmed as champions. Sheffield United, West Brom and Fulham are down. So the one remaining question is, who's going to get the top four races behind Man United and Man City? After the midweek action, as we mentioned before, Chelsea 6 points clear of West Ham and 7 from Liverpool. West Ham have one game in hand. Liverpool have two. Liverpool are in action this evening, then Sunday at West Brom, who are unbeaten, by the way, the Baggies, in their last four meetings with Liverpool. And then they finish off with Burnley away and Crystal Palace at home. That, I mean, on paper, you'd take that. West Ham are at Brighton on Saturday evening, who are now, of course, certain of staying up. And then they're away at West Brom, and then they finish at home to Southampton. As for Chelsea, they've got Leicester on Tuesday, and then away at Aston Villa. Are Chelsea going to do it?
I suspect they will. there's a sense of panic, I think, amongst certain elements of their support this morning in the wake of that defeat to Arsenal. And I'm not sure the panic is really justified. I mean, we're basically saying that the biggest threat appears to come from Liverpool, who would have to string together four wins on the bounce at the end of the season. And they really haven't shown that level of consistency since very early on in their title defence. Maybe they'll be spurred on by an unlikely and unexpected opportunity, but I really don't see it myself. So I suspect that Chelsea, if they need to pick a strong team at Aston Villa on the final day, they'll do that, and they should have enough to get through.
We saw how seriously Manchester United are going to take tonight's game by the team they put out against Leicester. And you know, there were some Liverpool fans saying this is a disgrace, and it goes against the sporting blah blah blah. But forgetting, maybe we saw Fulham go down this week, and in 2007, Liverpool rested their entire Premier League team against Fulham, which allowed Laurie Sanchez's unlikely survival campaign to succeed. So, every team does it from time to time, and it's just one of those things that you get late on in the season. And if they're that worried about it, win more games earlier in the campaign, really. So
that's very sound advice. Yeah, we'll see what happens Thursday night.
I mean, they were trying.
I don't know. For a few weeks, I'm not sure.
We'll come back to that then in Monday's show, once we know what on earth happened this weekend. Elsewhere, Spurs and Wolves this Sunday will have a key game in that race for the Europa League conference place. Everton and Sheffield United might have some bearing on that. What else? You've got Crystal Palace, Dom, taking on Aston Villa midweek. Palace got beaten 3-1 by Southampton. You're up in the scoring, though, with a fine goal from Christian Benteke.
Yeah.
Okay.
The race for 13th is very much on. to be honest, there is, for Palace fans, that there is a significance to the last couple of home games, not least because I think it's very, very likely, 99% likely, that Wednesday's visit of Arsenal will be Roy Hodgson's last game in charge at Crystal Palace at home. And you'd like to think that the club might offer some kind of clarity to the supporters ahead of that fixture to allow them to give him a proper send-off. Mm. I mean, there has been frustration amongst a certain element of the fan base over the style of football over the last couple of years, and I think the disconnect with games behind closed doors has probably exacerbated that. But, I'd like to think that he is showing a proper appreciation for everything he's done. He's the only manager in Palace's history to have kept the team in the division for 4 years and a bounce, always in comfortable mid-table as well. And he deserves a night of celebration and respect on Wednesday.
Okay, when you'll have fans back at Selhurst Park as well.
6,500 there, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. I was going to say, what would you like to see? Like a little present, carriage clock or something like that? Or and who would you like to see on the sideline for Palace next season? Or next week, if you're that, in a hurry.
Well, it's a shame that he goes out at Liverpool, isn't it? Of all places, but
not if he wins.
Not if he wins, no, true. So it's a shame that he goes out at Liverpool, isn't it? What would I like to see? Actually, deep down, I'd probably like to see him there for another year, but that's not going to happen, I don't think.
Yeah, that would put you in quite a minority of Palace fans.
Yeah, I think it would, but I think I'm slightly warier of the amount of change that might be instigated this summer, given the number of players that are also out of contract. I just wonder why you'd want to also change the management. But it is an opportunity for them. They consider it very much an opportunity. So if it is going to be a change, I'd probably say get something that's a younger model that won't make radical changes on the playing style necessarily and allows a bit of evolution there. I'd probably go for Sean Dyche.
It is good the fans will be back for Roy's potential last game. And 6,500 sounds quite low, but then it also occurred to me that's more than twice as many as were there at Selhurst Park for Wimbledon Everton in the official lowest attendance of a Premier League game. So
nice. It'll
be all right.
Amidst all the changes, the important thing presumably is to hang on to Christian Benteke, who's now notched up a whopping 8 Premier League goals this season. He has, Duncan, am I right in saying, more Premier League goals than Eric Cantona and Andriy Shevchenko put together? How is this possible?
Longevity, I think, is the word. But
I mean,
yeah,
he was He was really good for 3 years at Villa. I think people forget that he was... Yeah. I mean, Liverpool paid £32 million for him at a time when £32 million was a lot of money. And people weren't laughing at that the way they laughed at Andy Carroll for a similar amount of money. I mean, he was a serious player.
But it's interesting that I think that the two players in recent Premier League history who've had the longest spell of going out of form are Luke Shaw and Christian Benteke. And both, Shaw more than Benteke, I guess, but both have kind of started to come back to a good level this season. And, you know, often players don't get that gift of that long being out of form before that it's, you know, moved on to a lower division or elsewhere. But it is, I think both of them have plugged away and are getting, you know, credit for doing that.
Well, maybe they're the type of player. I mean, when matches were played behind closed doors, there was a lot of articles saying, you know, there's some players who might thrive behind closed doors. I mean, Benteke, someone who, you know, I'm sure has got a bit of stick from his own fans at times, has probably appreciated the lack of fans. Maybe Shaw as well. So that's interesting.
Also this weekend, Saints taking on Fulham, who of course were sent down by that 2-0 defeat at home to Burnley at the weekend. Burnley surviving despite a terrible start to their campaign. They only took 2 points from the first seven games, but that all seems a long time ago now. Danny Ings back for Saints, who of course were on the other end of that 3-1 scoreline against Palace midweek. Looking good, no?
I thought the first goal was just exceptional. I mean, in a way, it's one of those where I almost feel like goals like that should be a contender for goal of the month. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
Describe it, Michael.
Redmond went down the left, crossed the ball. Not a very convertible opportunity, not a very presentable opportunity. And Ings' first touch was good. And then he got to the loose ball quicker than anyone else. And then just put it perfectly in the corner past the goalkeeper. And I just think sometimes, you know, we marvel at 25-yard strikes that go in the top corner when the ball's kind of sitting up nicely for a player coming onto it. But I think a lot of players could score goals like that. I don't think many strikers could do what Danny Ings did in that situation. He just He turns quarter chances into goals with you know, pretty regularly.
He doesn't look, does he? He doesn't look at all at the goal. He knows exactly where it is, and there's no backlift whatsoever. Brilliant. You look at it first time, you think, there's no way that's going in, and it's just perfect in the corner. There's no way Gaita can save it.
What did you make of Mason Greenwood's similarly nestling in the corner effort against Leicester midweek?
I thought that was exceptional, and he scored almost the reverse goal, I think, in the previous game, hadn't he, where he hit it with his left foot into the bottom right corner as he's looking at it. And this one, it was with his right foot across the goalkeeper. I mean, he had a spell of poor form earlier this season in terms of goals. But when you looked at his shots, he was hitting the woodwork so much. And I think he just really seems to go for the corners, for almost the inside of the post. And when he gets it in, it's so precise. I mean, I thought that there's been a couple of goals he's scored where it's really obvious the defender doesn't know which way to show him, because he's so good with both feet. And I think that's an underrated aspect of being two-footed. I'd say the same about Mane, who I know hasn't had a great season, but he's so good at spinning. And it's partly because defenders have no idea which way to show him. But Green was great. And he seems to me the most likely beneficiary of the 26-man Euro squad, because I'm not sure he was going to get in. But now with the number of... I just think because Southgate is so intent on playing three and four at the back at different stages, he was going to take one too many defenders and probably leave out an attacker. And I think him and Saka probably were going to get the cut. But now it's 26. I think you load up on attacking options, and he's about three attacking options in one combined Greenwood. Yeah. So I think he'll go now. Yeah.
I think it's also interesting with players like Greenwood and Ings that you can now analyse stuff like where they put the ball and how reliable they are at doing that much better than you used to be able to. And I think, you know, obviously Ings has been linked with a move back to a big club this summer, and then, which I always think is quite a sort of Serie A sort of thing, where a player's at a big club, then goes to a smaller club, does well, and then goes back to another big club. But, you know, City, I think he would be a perfect signing for someone like Man City, who aren't going to play the kind of, you know, strikerless role in a game, say their annual 8-0 win against Watford, whereas Ings would, you know, happily snap up, you know, five or six goals in a match like that. So, yeah, I mean, Southampton would obviously love to keep him, but I think he's going to be a very in-demand player this summer.
I think that role's really interesting, isn't it, where a side needs a striker, but they don't necessarily want to spend $100 million on a player who you then have to start week in, week out. Another player I think could do a decent job as a plan B for someone like Arsenal is Mitrovic, who doesn't fit into a passing style at all and isn't going to be a regular. But I think if you want to lob the ball to someone with 20 minutes to go, probably only Giroud, I think, would be a better super sub in the Premier League than Mitrovic.
Benteke's on a free.
Yeah.
There you go. Just struggling with the notion of Mitrovic at Arsenal. It's not a natural...
I think you do. I mean, he wouldn't start many games, but I think Arsenal, since they lost Giroud, there's so many games where he used to come on and do a job for him. Right. It's a real specialist role, but you look at Mitrovic's scoring record at international level. He scored 42 goals, I think it is, for Serbia. I mean, he really knows how to score, but just in certain situations that probably only occur towards the end of games.
Mm. All right, well, there'll be a whole summer of this kind of chatter to come as the transfer market gets underway. Before that, though, we have got a few games left to go, and Man City, just to round off this weekend's fixtures, Friday, in fact, will be at St James's Park getting their guard of honour from Newcastle as they run out as title winners for the third time in four seasons, etc. and so on. Quick word for our excellent subscription offer. If you sign up with The Athletic for just £4 a month, you'll get unrivaled coverage on this business end of the season. All the articles, all the podcasts, ad-free and Q&As with writers. That's all available at theathletic.com/totally. And now to wrap up today's edition of the Totally Football Show, it is Intertotally time.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The Inter Totally Cup, sponsored by Paddy Power. Stadiums might not yet be full, but Paddy's offers are at full capacity. Get a free bet if one leg of your 4-plus fold ACCA lets you down on all football matches and markets.
T's and C's apply. 18+, begambleaware.org.
Inter Totally Time. Second semi-final, in fact. Now, last week, drama as Sasha Gurionov ran champion Michael Cox this close. Went to a tiebreak, but it was Coxie here who won a place in the final. Today, he and we will find out who he's going to be facing there. Let's meet the contestants.
Up first, looking to go one step further than his beloved PSG, or at least going out with a little bit more dignity. Zut alors, it's Julien Laurent.
Who played along with the drums, listener? I know I did. Jules, so good to have you back with us. Sorry about that slightly disrespectful intro there, but you know, you are 6 questions away from the final. How do you feel?
I feel excited. I feel a bit tense. I have to, you know, to be honest, those big games in the history of, you know, of my career haven't always been great, but I believe this time.
Okay, yeah, Lindsay in the first round. Then, of course, the tiebreaker with James Horncastle. Real.
Epic. Yeah,
just so dramatic. Okay, well, if you go through, of course, you'll also pick up, as you know, £10 for the charity of your choice, which Paddy Power will put on a bet of your choice as well. Last time you had as your wager that Juve would finish outside the top four, which is currently looking pretty good.
yeah, that's pretty good.
What's it going to be this time, and what's the charity again?
So the charity is Dementia UK, again, right. Really close to my heart, as you know. And the bet this time is that Atletico Madrid will win La Liga this season.
Okay, well, after Barca's result midweek, it's looking that much more likely. What about your progress to the final? How likely is that? Well, let's meet the man you're up against. Let me see those hands in the air.
Hell on up. Hey, everybody jump. And his opponent. It's the underdog story everyone's needed in 2021. But when it comes to quizzes, this dog's bite is much worse than his bark. Safari's so good, Benji Laniardo.
Benji!
Yeah, Safari's so good. That's really good.
Thanks for coming along. Thanks for bringing that music as well. I needed a bit of a lift at this stage of the podcast. What an Inter Totally it's been for you, you dark horse, you.
Yeah, living the dream. I feel like Chesterfield in 1997. It's just so unexpected, and I'm enjoying myself, and I just want the fans to have a good day out today.
Right, but I mean, Alvaro and then Lang and the birth of a small child and amongst that.
God, yeah.
Absolutely, and with Jules as well, European competition, which is, as a West Ham fan, it's always the objective. So I'm very excited. I'm very just happy to be here.
Okay, well, if you get through this, of course, it is the reigning champion, Michael Cox, in the final. Let's hear about your charity and your wager.
It's the Whittington Hospital, where my child was born, and they looked after my wife during a rather tricky run-up to his birth, a hospital in Archway. They're an NHS hospital, but people don't realise that you can donate money to NHS hospitals, and they've all got charitable trusts, so it's not just the taxpayer. And the bet is perhaps not particularly charitable to my beloved England football team. It's that it's double chance that Scotland will either win or draw against England in the Euros. That's my bet.
All right. Well, last time you went for an all-English Champions League final, and that one came through, so we'll see about this. Right now, though, there's only one question on all of our minds, and that's who's going to make it to the final. Let's get quizzical. Jules, you're up first. Here's question one. Otmar Hitzfeld did it in 1997 and 2001. Jose Mourinho did it in 2004 and 2010. What is it, and who did it in 98 and 2013?
It's winning the treble and Joop Heynckes did it. Ooh. Winning the Champions League and Joop Heynckes did it.
I mean, you're right about Joop Heynckes. I can't fault you on that. We could give you a half. I don't know. What do you think, Charlie? No halves, says Charlie.
No halves.
It's winning the Champions League with different clubs.
Oh.
So close, though, Jules. So close. Question two. Which Championship club did Nigel Pearson finish the season as manager of?
Birmingham?
Nope. Bristol City. Question three. You need this, Jules. Yeah. Where did Germany's 7-1 humiliation of Brazil in the 2014 World Cup semi-final take place?
In Sao Paulo.
No, it's famous for this as well. The Mineirão. Belo Horizonte, the Mineirão is the name of the stadium. All right, Jules, three questions to go. Sven-Göran Eriksson's last job was with which national side?
Greece.
No, it was the Philippines.
Wow.
Benji, how are you doing over there? Have you got any of these so far?
Yeah, 4 out of 4.
Okay. Question five. Samuel Eto'o played for Inter. And which other team in Serie A?
Milan.
No, it was Sampdoria. Jules. Here comes question six. Make this one count. In the Euro 96 semi-final, France lost on penalties to the Czech Republic. Reinald Pedros missed his penalty. But can you name the five players who scored?
No way. Nah.
Can you name any of them?
I would think Blanc might have scored.
That's one.
Zidane.
Yes, it's two.
I would go for... I mean, it's pure... Apart from Blanc and Zidane, the rest is a pure guess. So I would go for... Maybe someone like Angloma. Did Angloma was on pen?
No.
No, I would not.
But you got two of the five. We'll keep that in mind when we get to Benji's equivalent question. So not really sure how to score that, but it's not good, whatever number you put on it, Jules.
I think it's zero. We can say it.
Kind of zero, unless Benji gets less than two, I think, on his question six. So we'll see. Yeah, Jules, I mean, they were tough questions, no question.
I didn't know any answers, literally. Right. They were all guesses, so...
Right.
Tough
okay.
round.
Well, let's see. There's always the possibility that Benji might have a similarly awful time and then you can do him on a tiebreaker. Let's see. Benji, you ready?
Mm-hmm. Let's go.
All right, then. Question one. What are Miguel Munoz, Carlo Ancelotti, Pep Guardiola and Zinedine Zidane the only men to achieve? Those names again. Miguel Munoz, Carlo Ancelotti, Pep Guardiola and Zinedine Zidane. They've all done something that nobody else has.
Have they won the Champions League as a player and manager or European Cup?
Charlie can't give it. No, I'm hearing what? That's not enough. That's not enough. Could you be more specific, Benji?
and they are all male. Men.
Well, this
they're
is
men
true,
as well.
But I know. Okay, Jules, tell him.
With the same club.
Exactly. As I said.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
That's what I meant. I didn't say it. But, yeah.
No,
you don't get any points for that,
though,
James.
No, no points for intentions. Question two. Which championship club did Mick McCarthy finish this season as manager of?
Cardiff.
Is correct. Benji Lagnardo, you
Whoa.
Are in the
cool.
final. Woo! Brilliant. All right, whatever happens from here on in, you got a date with Michael Cox. All righty. Tell you what, let's race through the rest of the questions. Question three. Where did Italy's dramatic semi-final victory over Germany at the 2006 World Cup take place?
Let's say Munich.
Let's give you no points for that whatsoever. It was at Signal Iduna Park or Westfalenstadion, Borussia Dortmund's ground. Question four. With which team did Sven-Göran Eriksson lose a European Cup final?
Oh. Good question. Lazio didn't get there. He got famous with Gothenburg. Then he went to Benfica. Did Benfica get to a European Cup final? A Champions League final or a European Cup final?
European Cup final.
Hey, let's just say Benfica.
That is correct, Benji. Jules, I know you knew that one.
Yeah, I have to say, his questions are far easier than mine. Easy.
I agree.
Yeah, really, really much easier. I mean, Philippines compared to Benfica, there's not even a debate.
Is the Parisian losing his in the semi? I'm just pointing.
It's me being sent off. Or it's just a season where everything goes West Ham's way, you know. That's the way it is.
All right. Question five. Which Serie A club did Nicolas Anelka have a short spell at?
Come on. That's way easier than Samuel Eto'o.
I don't think I know the answer.
That's a disgrace.
Oh my God, Jules is putting his flip-flops
on. I'm going to go to Cass. I don't care. I'm going to go to Cass. As soon as we hang up, I'm going to go to Cass.
I'm going to guess AC Milan.
It was Juventus.
Juventus.
Yes. And question six. Let's see if you can beat Jules' total of two on this one. England lost on penalties to Germany in the Euro 96 semi-final. Gareth Southgate missed his penalty. Can you name the five players who scored, Benji?
Shearer. Stuart Pearce. David Platt.
That's three. Yeah. You've got two more to find.
Anderson?
No. It was Gascoigne and Sheringham.
Gascoigne
and Sheringham. Christ.
Listen, I'm giving myself the first question. So that's I'm giving myself 3 hours.
Well, who makes the rules in this game? I don't understand. Who's the referee? Is Benji the referee?
I think we can all agree that two is more than zero. So, Benji, you're going through to take on Michael Cox. How do you feel about that?
Lucky. That was scrappy. I mean, we've seen some good matchups in this tournament so far. That was not one of them.
Well,
such a bad semi-final.
Hey, but Jules, don't worry. There's always the third, fourth place playoff, surely, you know, and that's really important. And you know, that's a chance to really, you know, show your mettle.
We haven't actually got one of those in place, but maybe we should hastily draw up a Sasha v. Jules playoff. If, Jules, would you like that?
Yeah, we'd love to. Yeah. Lost
dignity?
I think that is the final that the public probably wanted. I think Sasha's the best quizzer in the competition, I think.
Well, the statistics say he isn't, Benji. But you're right, he did get knocked out by an incredibly tense semi-final with Michael Cox. Anyway, Jules, any explanation for your total collapse?
Some really tough questions, I have to say, that I didn't know. Far harder than my opponent, I have to stress that. And again, Cass will hear from me. Well done to Benji. I think he deserves it completely. And it's been an amazing year for him so far with, you know, West Ham playing crap, but still making it, you know, to fifth place. And then, most importantly, the baby being born and healthy and all of that. So I wish him the best of luck, and I really hope he wins this final.
Benji, you've been the big surprise of this competition. First time in the Intertotally Cup, and look at you, already in the final. It's the stuff of fairy tales.
It's wild. I'd like to thank Wikipedia and Insomnia and the combination of the two that helps you know that Mick McCarthy is the manager of Cardiff.
Bingo. Jules, thank you so much. Congratulations for making it this far. Benji, we'll see you in the final.
Mazel tov, Benji. You're through to the final of the Intertotally Cup. And if you concur with Benji's hunch that Scotland will win or draw against England at the Euros next month, it's priced at 12-5 at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Odds are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. And please, gamble responsibly.
Well, there we go, Michael. What did you make of that? Worried?
Not particularly on the strength of that, no, but look forward to Jules atoning for his errors with the third place playoff against Sasha, who I think is probably the most knowledgeable player in the game. That right. should be a very tight contest.
Jules felt that his questions were that much harder, as he heard. As an impartial panel, what did you feel?
I think what it shows is that if you're English, you know penalty shootouts intimately because they haunt your every dreams. Whereas if you're France, who win a major competition every few years, it doesn't really matter if you lose a penalty shootout, does it? So,
right. Well, even Benji didn't get all five of his. 2 points for Benji out of six. Michael, how many points did you get in yours? Was it five or four?
No, four all it was.
Four. Still, it is a worryingly John Jensen aspect to Benji, as you pointed out before, and his kind of unexpected race to the final. Just saying, the winds of destiny are behind him.
As a neutral, as a supposed neutral at this point, I think the questions for this semi-final were a lot harder than the first semi-final. Just saying.
Well, it doesn't matter. We're not the two semi-finals. No, I'm not saying
it. That's as it may be. But I just
of comparing the scores, there's maybe
there's a handicap for the second one.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. I think we are going to have this third, fourth playoff, and I think that'll be next week. And then, of course, the big final, the showdown between the champion and the challenger. Can Michael upset the odds and defeat Benji Lanyardo? All right. That, though, is still to come. For today, we'll wrap up this Totally Football show. Many thanks, Dom, for being with us, and Duncan, and Michael, and producer Charlie, and above all, you, listener. We'll be back Monday morning, so have a great weekend in the meanwhile. And from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. $5. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.